The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Who's the sexiest bunny, Easter or Playboy?
How do I stop slugs eating my bok choy? When we last spoke to you in Answer Me This, episode 349, a month ago...
Days I'll remember all my life.
God, that was nice. Just nice. Carry on. We don't have to do the chat. listener Peter was
Lady
in...
Peter.
Lady called Peter in Hunter Valley, Australia, had written in about her neighbour who was shooting kangaroos and leaving the roo corpses to rot.
You remember that email, listeners. It's a memorable moment.
And about a month later, those kangaroos... are
still
really,
stink.
Really ponging.
Yeah.
But Gina, who is also in Australia, has written in. Peter said that she had moved to Hunter Valley.
Yes.
As a tree change, an expression that was new to us. Gina says, tree change means to move to the countryside to escape the fast pace of life in the city.
Okay, well, we sort of guess what it meant from context.
Yeah, but I did wonder whether it was a typo.
Right, okay.
Gina says, it is a version of the word sea change, which means to move to the beach to escape the fast pace of life in the city. That's not how it's used in The Tempest.
No, so I was going to say, because I always thought that sea change kind of just meant a change of view or temperament,
yes,
based
or
on the tempest of the sea.
Gina says it is also the title of an extremely popular 90s Australian TV drama, Sea Change, which popularised the idea.
Okay.
Maybe if you grew up at the beach, if you're the child of the people who did a sea change, you need somewhere to escape to, which is where the tree change comes in. Because you don't want a sea change to a sea change, do you? So you have to escape inland to the country.
I don't know, but I'm enjoying all these words. I wonder what else there could be. Pee change when you move to a building with better sanitary conditions.
Or worse.
Yeah. Knee change when you need geriatric surgery.
Ski change.
Ski change, yeah.
That's when you move to the mountains.
When you move to the mountains. Now, that does work.
Yeah.
When I used to work as a researcher on This Morning, mm-hmm. the word gear change used to be used quite frequently on the autocue. I don't know if this is something they still do, but I imagine it is, because nothing at This Morning has fundamentally changed since 1992.
And is that when the presenter had to do an extremely sharp tonal shift?
Correct.
Here's a mouse windsurfing. Cancer mum.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah. So it's basically a Richard Madeley prevention device. It's basically saying, Richard, you can riff on the autocue all you like, but right now you're going into Somalian orphans, so don't make a joke about this cucumber looking like a cock. That's basically what the gear change on the autocue meant.
We have also another correspondent from Australia, Kim from Melbourne. Ollie, answer me this. Has the deconstructed coffee reached London?
Ah.
I sent it over a month ago. I'm not familiar with this. Is this just, can mean, have coffee beans and milk reached London?
She's referring to a trend which I guess, like most coffee trends in the last few years, has come from Melbourne, Australia, which is presenting a coffee, even if it's not ordered, as a deconstructed coffee. And this is the important point, I think. This is why there's been the...
fury. Yeah, outcry.
Exactly, the outrage.
Devastation.
It's a bit like your Food on Slates thing. People are feeling like they're not given the choice here.
I bet they can deconstruct coffee and put it on a slate, can't they?
Yeah, I bet they can.
Oh, you dip one end of the slate in coffee, the other end in milk. Sprinkle a line of sugar down the middle. There you go. Yum, yum.
Some Melbourne coffee houses you go to and there's a chance that when you order a coffee, it will come out on a wooden plank with three little beakers. One is full of frothed milk,
mm-hmm.
one is a shot of espresso,
mm-hmm.
and one is hot water. And the idea is you mix it yourself.
Interesting.
Bullshit, I say.
It's, on the one hand, kind of empowering you to make the perfect concentration of coffee for you.
Yes.
On the other, it's forcing you to do a lot of work.
I suppose, like so many food trends, it comes from a desire to Instagram the food, doesn't it? It's like, how can we present coffee in a way that someone's going to take a picture of it and put it on Twitter? But the problem is they're going to put it on Twitter with the hashtag twat. That's the problem.
It's not just about the Instagram moment, Ollie. It happens before that. People are bewitched by a new or beautiful visual presentation of things to eat and drink, aren't they? So, to be fair, it might just be the novelty that the expensive coffee market needs. And in a couple of years' time, they'll want their coffee in a polystyrene cup, just as the backlash to this.
Maybe. I mean...
Or they'll want it in a super soaker and you fire it into their mouths.
But most of the trends that are going to kind of catch on internationally do come by London fairly soon after Melbourne. And this one hasn't really arrived. I mean, it may exist in Shoreditch, but essentially it hasn't arrived. So I think this is a stupid idea. Otherwise, it would be more common already.
Is it that Londoners are too stingy? Is it that they don't want you in the coffee shop spending that amount of time? They want you to get it and leave.
I think that's it in London, isn't it? Yeah, table rent is not worth... It's better for you to just buy your coffee and fuck off.
If you're getting a takeaway coffee as well, do they give you 3 paper cups?
Oh, God. Don't get me going on the reusable cups. Like, this has been my personal kind of bourgeois nightmare in the last couple of weeks, actually.
Nightmare.
Because...
Worst thing in the world.
I try and do the right thing and get the reusable cups. Yeah. And actually, Starbucks have quite a good one because it's cheap. It's only £1. And it's one that you can use, I think, something like 50 times before you throw it away. It's just slightly harder and firmer.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, that's great. I'll get one of those. And I did. And I carried it around with me every day for a week. And it just so happened that week, I was working in a place that was next door to Starbucks. I got my 25% off or whatever it is.
Yep.
I was happy. The next week, I'm a freelancer. I can't help this. The next week, I was working in a place that was near a Costa.
Oh, do you think you can't cross-pollinate?
It's not that I can't. It's that I just couldn't bear to have the conversation. I just thought, I know what's going to happen. There'll have to be bants about this. I'll have to get my Starbucks cup out my bag and ask for a discount at the Costa. And they'll have to say, wrong cup, mate. And I just didn't want to have that conversation.
It's funny that you think they give a shit. Just buy a third-party cup for, say, £8.
No, that's the obvious solution.
Yes, it is.
So, but the problem is I now have the Starbucks one. So then, you know, if I'm doing it to not use too many cups, I'm then buying a second cup, which is unnecessary.
Yeah, but you then got a disposable cup at Costa because of your shame. So yes, it would have been a better economy to get the brand agnostic cup.
Well, I did. Yes, that would be the best thing, yeah. And the best thing, obviously, would be get an Answer Me This cup made so that we could be promoting our podcast at the same time as filling up coffee in a variety of different chain and independent shops.
Turn the mics off. We're going to go on Cafe Press right now when we come back. That will be an available product. You can drink out of something with your own face on. How do you think you will feel going into Costa with your own face cup? Do you think that will be more or less embarrassing than going
That's
in with Starbucks?
That's the
bants
that I want. Absolutely.
Hi, Helen and Ollie. It's Johnny from Hackney. I was walking past Bank Station. I'm wondering, is Bank Station called Bank Station because it's got lots of banks there? Or is that a really stupid question?
Yeah, that's a stupid question.
Well, not necessarily, because although we all know as Londoners that bank has a long history of banks, maybe if you're...
Bank of England, isn't it?
Sure. Maybe if you're just a visitor to our city, maybe...
Yeah, then maybe, it's not
Johnny
a question.
From Hackney.
Yeah. Well, you know...
It's not even that far from
probably,
Bank Station.
He may well have never left Hackney. Could be that you might think the name sort of was reverse engineered and then banks chose to set up in Bank more recently.
What does Johnny think happens in Cockfosters, eh?
It would be amazing nominative determinism, wouldn't it, if you set up a part of London which was like, I don't know, sports place, and then stadiums started appearing.
Or he could think it was on a riverbank, and then the Thames got silted up, so Bank is a bit further away from the river's edge than it used to be.
Well, there is the embankment to the south, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And actually, I did used to get those sort of semi-dyslexically kind of confused in my head.
And there's Bank Side, which is where in by the Tate. It's not that far away.
But no, it is named after the Bank of England, which
is... And you are stupid, Johnny.
Which is literally right there as you come out of the exit.
In fact, the Bank of England has been on that site since 1734. It's the world's 8th oldest bank. It was founded in 1694.
Only the 8th oldest?
Yeah, what's older than that?
Well, it's the 2nd oldest central bank after this Swedish one. And the Swedish one is only from 1600s as well. So I think it was just the whole economics worked differently before that. It was quite a complicated story about why they started up the Bank of England to do with a big national debt after a battle that I had not heard of, that France won.
Right.
And so then, we don't crow about that one very much.
No, it really was a history's written by the victors one.
2 world wars and a national bank.
But yeah, the station is named after the Bank of England and it opened on the 25th of February 1900. I was curious to read that Monument Station, which is very near to Bank, Monument Station opened 1884. It was named Eastcheap after the nearby street. But within a month, it was renamed Monument.
Mm.
What is with that?
Well, was the monument there when the station opened?
There, and that is what is with that. I mean, sometimes you just get it wrong, don't you?
It's impressive to me that they realised they'd made a mistake that quickly.
I think North Greenwich...
Paint was still wet.
...should have been called Dome. I mean, I know the Dome is now known as the O2, but that's a corporate
branding. Yeah, but it's still a dome, isn't it? It doesn't matter the branding.
And like Millennium Dome was always a bit naff, but it should have been called Dome. Like,
I think Millennium Dome's okay. You've got Millennium Bridge and Millennium Wheel.
Yeah.
I think the problem is a lot of people can't remember how many L's and how many N's are in Millennium, and it's just a bit of a pain to spell.
But for tourists, it's a pain as well, like, because then it has to say North Greenwich
for
the
O2 Arena. Yeah.
Do you think it was because they wanted to regenerate or even generate the area that is North Greenwich, and so they had to make it sound a bit like Greenwich that was already pretty spiffy?
That's true, yeah.
So maybe it was.
Where do you live in your spiffy apartment block? I live in Dome. Yeah, like you live in a French restaurant.
Or a bell end.
Yeah.
If you've got a question, email your question to answermethispodcast@googlemail.com. 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 Answermethispodcast@googlemail.com.
Here's a question from Emma from Washington, D.C., who says, a few years back, as a Christmas present for my husband, I had a portrait of us and our cat done by an artist on Etsy. It's sort of kitschy, continues Emma, so acknowledging that.
Yeah, okay.
And cartoony, but pleasant, not like what you get at a theme park. That's quite a low bar, ooh, I think, for portraiture.
Oh, like a caricature.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. It's not as bad as
it's
a caricature.
It's not as bad as a caricature.
I like the fact, Martin, that your parents have a caricature of your dad in their kitchen.
They've got two.
Why does he keep... What? Who needs more than one caricature of themselves done in their lifetime?
Well, I mean, that question really means who goes on more than one summer holiday? And plenty. You know, it's something to do, isn't it? A lot of British holiday resorts, that is all there is to do.
Right. I've been on holiday and I've not had a single caricature done. And I feel fine about
it. We should get one done.
No, thanks. I'm fine.
Actually, I mean, now you have some quite characterful spectacles, you could do a good caricature of you.
Yeah, but I probably wouldn't be wearing them on holiday because they're mainly for computer work.
Well... Often I find, often, like, this is a regular occurrence, I'm digging back into personal experience here from when I was 7 and went on holiday every year to a place in Sardinia where there was a resident caricaturist.
So often in 1988 in Sardinia. Yeah,
exactly. I
found... Can anyone ratify this?
That when a person was presented to a caricaturist that didn't have any particularly prominent features, they'd often just use the ones that were like their trademark stock features.
Well, like making a big nose or a big chin or something like that.
I was quite an ugly 14-year-old.
Oh, say it isn't so.
But can you believe? But at 8, I was, I would say, generic looking. And I've still got the caricature. And basically, he put freckles all over my face. And I've never had, nor do I have now, freckles.
Oh.
So it must have just been like, oh, it's an 8-year-old. Let's give him freckles. Because there's nothing to accentuate on 8-year-old. Or perhaps if you do the big nose, it's like you can't do that to an 8-year-old. I don't know. Mm. What the rules are there.
Well, Martin's dad is a caricaturist dream because he has several trademarks. Beard,
yeah.
Hat. Think glasses as well sometimes?
Yeah, he wears glasses.
So once you've got the beard and the hat, there's not that much face left to artificially enlarge in a caricaturist way. You just make his whole head big and his body small,
well,
and
also,
you're done.
They've drawn Father Christmas before, so it's just that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Emma continues. Since having this portrait done, we've had a baby who is now 1 year old.
Congrats.
We think we may have more children eventually, but these things, you can't really know 100% how they will turn out. I'd love to have the same artist represent all members of our eventual family, so Helen, answer me this. Should we have a portrait of the one-year-old done now, or should we wait and do all our children when we think we are done having kids?
Is she worried that if she leaves it, then the artist will have retired from portraiture in 10 years or whenever their not yet existent kids are out?
No, I think this is... pure economics, this.
Right.
I think she just doesn't want to spend money now that she might then have to spend again later.
Right, so she's thinking, do an all children one at the end of their popping out kids phase so that she doesn't have to get individual ones per child and then end up having to get 5 done.
Yes, although to me...
expensive.
This is about whether or not you want to immortalise a one-year-old anyway.
Well, I quite agree, Ollie, because when you think about it, how many paintings are there of one-year-old babies that aren't creepy as fuck?
Mm.
Or in pictures of, say, newborn Jesus, he looks like a 4-year-old. He does not look like a newborn baby at all. I'm not saying he should have gunk all over his face and a misshapen skull. Just saying he looks like a toddler standing up on Mary's knee with quite well-developed facial structure and golden curls and all of that.
Now, without having a sort of massive detour into art history,
yeah.
Why is that? Is that because portraiture at that time that had a religious element was about deference to Jesus and making him look sort of better than a baby?
Maybe.
Or was it, I wonder, that the models that they had to work on, you know, if you were posing for days for Michelangelo, was a 4-year-old, not a baby, for obvious reasons?
Or I wonder... just thinking back to when we did a question about whether there were any paintings of pregnant Mary, whether they thought that painting a baby was a bit obscene in some way, or whether they wanted him to look a bit more like he would be capable of miraculous speech. I don't know.
It's true, you don't see many portraits of one-year-olds.
I remember my brothers once asked me when they had little babies if I would paint them as a present for my mum, and I said no.
Now, I haven't seen all of your artistic work, but that which I have is done in quite a sort of faux-naive style. Is that how you would do that for them?
Well, I didn't want to, because what I find interesting is painting faces that are a bit lived in.
Mm.
And also, I find it a lot easier if there's bone structure, which with a baby, they have chubby, adorable faces.
Mm.
Just take a shitload of photos of a baby, right?
That's the other thing I was going to say. I mean, being someone who's in possession of a baby, I mean, he's 15 months old now, but still just about baby.
And adorable. So I can understand that you want to look at a picture of him, but...
My phone is full of pictures of my son.
Yeah.
So I sort of don't need... I mean, I know... Don't get me wrong. I know that, you know, visual art that you hang on the mantelpiece is different to a photo, even if you put it in a frame. But if I was going to immortalise a period of his life, I'd probably rather it was one that I hadn't extensively and exhaustively documented anyway.
Yes. I think also, even if you wait a few years so the kid is five and doesn't look like they will as an adult, obviously, but still the portrait artist will be able to capture something of their personality.
Yes.
Whereas a one-year-old baby, that is harder to discern. Obviously, they do exhibit personality, but it's more tricky for them to show a little glint in their eye, say, or a mischievous facial expression.
Although the only sort of official... professionally taken photograph of me that hangs in all of my family, you know, extended family's homes, is my sort of official bar mitzvah photo, which my dad was apoplectic about because he was paying for it. He was quite insistent that for my official bar mitzvah photo, i.e. the one that would be given to all my close relatives when they came, that I wasn't wearing my religious gear. But at the time, because I'd been brainwashed for 2 years into this is the ceremony whereby you become a man in the eyes of God, I was taking it quite seriously, and I thought it was the responsible thing to do, to pose as if I was Orthodox. So the photo that hangs in all of my family's homes of me is me looking very awkward, age 12 anyway, but like wearing a couple, reading the Bible. It's not necessarily the most accurate depiction of my character. So you'd look at that picture and assume that they became a devout child. I didn't.
Right, so what you're saying is, ideally, if you are having any sort of picture of your child for posterity, make it not too specific in any way. Give it a kind of timeless quality. But then this artist clearly has a strong style of their own, so maybe it's kind of irrelevant anyway.
Maybe, yeah.
What your baby looks like.
I think in any case, I think what we're saying is wait.
I think so. The danger of waiting is that if your child is sitting for the portrait artist, then a five-year-old won't sit still. But then if you're sending off for it on Etsy, they probably do it for photos anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Also, I mean, you don't want to wait so long that the hormones kick in and the child hates you.
Yeah.
That's not the period you want immortalised.
Yeah. When my dad sculpted my brothers, they were both, I can't remember, 5 or 8 years old.
Yeah. Does it look like them now?
Little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, the hairlines are more generous than reality.
Was it a good choice, though, to go for that age, do you think?
Well, I think if he'd done it when they were adults, then they would have been able to talk back and critique the sculpture as it was happening.
I think you've said this on the show before, but if you did, it was years ago, so it's worth asking again.
No, he didn't want to sculpt me.
That's what I was just about, really.
Never even asked. Maybe he looked at my NHS glasses and thought, there is not a substance that I can sculpt with that can express these.
Would you sit for him now if he asked to sculpt you? I mean, I realise that he's doddery now and it would take him a while.
Yeah, that's the thing, I can't afford the 18 months. No.
Right.
I think I wouldn't, but that's because I don't want a portrait of me to exist. And also, I feel like he'd be looking at me in a very critical way, which that was a whole thing in my childhood that I don't want to return
to. Right, sure, yeah. Have you ever done a self-portrait? I mean, I guess your comment, there isn't a portrait of me that exists, suggests you haven't.
Yeah, at school, we had to do self-portraits made out of strips of newspaper, which I think was an exercise to teach us about using something pre-existing like newsprint in different ways to express light and shade on your own face.
Hmm. Well done for deducing any kind of lesson from art lessons at school. I still don't know what any of those were about.
It was a quite good portrait of someone else.
Would you as a couple like to have a portrait of yourself done?
Fuck no!
No, but perhaps...
Fuck no!
But perhaps from a sort of Etsy style.
Nope.
Crafty.
We don't even have pictures of ourselves around. There aren't even that many pictures of
us
together, are
you
there?
Don't really. Do either of you have as wallpaper on your phone photos of yourself?
Wallpaper on my phone is a picture of Zion National Park in Utah. Wallpaper on my iPad is a manatee.
Martin?
My iPhone is a birthday card with swans smoking.
Right.
And my iPad is a glacier in Iceland.
Okay, right, so you hate looking at each other. Okay, fine, good, welcome.
We can see look at each other all the fucking time. We don't need to be reminded through every electronic item.
Well, yes. You don't need to look at us, thankfully, but you can listen to us.
That is for the best. We chose this medium wisely.
You can listen to us to your heart's content, especially if your heart is as big as your wallet, by buying our archive material.
Yes, you can get Answer Me This episodes 1 to 200, along with our albums and...
Apps.
And our old best of episodes, I think, if you want just a little taster.
Yep.
That's all at answermethisstore.com.
Yes, and for today's intermission...
Here is a little nugget from Answer Me This episode 153.
Hi, this is Phil in Stockport. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. In the 1989 Roald Dahl film The Witches, in the scene where the Grand High Witch, played by the lovely Angelica Houston, is addressing this crowd of baying biddies, are some of the witches in the crowd actually men? Because some of them look very, very dubious indeed.
Well, before we answer that, can I just pick you up, Phil? You can't call it a Roald Dahl film. The tradition is to name the film after the director. So in this case... it's a Nicholas Rogue film.
What?
And I wanted to make
Nicholas
that point.
Rogue,
because that's the extraordinary thing, Nicholas Rogue.
Of Don't Look Now.
Of Don't Look Now.
And other films.
Directed forgotten 90s children's film starring Angelica Houston and some Muppets, The Witches, yes. Most of them were men. And one of them is a cameo by Michael Palin.
No.
Whoa.
Yeah, no dialogue. Michael Palin playing a witch in the background of that film.
Wow.
Fact. Here's a question from Elena. She says,
nothing more I can do.
I live in the US and occasionally I hear the term citizen's arrest.
And it's usually accompanied by someone grabbing my arms and forcing me down onto the pavement.
I hope you don't hear it too often, Lena. Usually I hear it in a movie or a TV show.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying.
I am dying to know if citizen's arrest is a real thing or just something made up for movies that acts as a comedic device or to move the plot along.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was just that, that would be a very hackneyed device, wouldn't it? I mean, it comes up a lot, the idea of the citizen's arrest. Helen, answer me this. If it is a real thing, how does it work?
Well, it works differently in different countries. And in fact, in the USA, it's different from state to state. For instance, in North Carolina, you can't do it. There's not a law there that allows citizen's arrest.
Okay, but in places where movies are more typically set... the West, New York City, can you do it there?
Well, I think you can do it in all the states except North Carolina, but different terms and conditions apply. And it is actually really, really complicated. So looking at lots of different countries' citizens' arrest technicalities, some countries will allow you to do it to prevent a crime, but in others, the crime has to have happened. And in some, you would have had to see the crime taking place. So catch the criminal in flagrante delicto, and that would be the term legally that is used. And
the one that, of course, is being used on the streets of San Francisco at the moment it happens. Yeah.
It means in blazing offence. But I didn't know it in this context. I only knew it as a kind of coy sex term. In other places, you just need to have reasonable suspicion that this crime had taken place. And then in some places, the crime has to be something for which you would receive a prison sentence. I think in Ireland, it has to be something for which you would receive a sentence of 5 or more years. So you'd have to have quite a good working knowledge of the legal system. But in other places, it could just be a minor misdemeanor or a disturbance or creating public affray.
But what does it permit you to do if you put someone on citizen's arrest?
Again, it varies from place to place what you have to do. But basically, you have to use reasonable force, as in not too much force. And by using the term reasonable, the law is fudging this a bit, but they all recommend you do not cause injury to the person. I think it would be okay to make them lie down and then sit on their back so they can't get away while you call the police, but punching them until they were knocked out, not okay.
Yeah,
not reasonable force.
Even without the terminology citizen's arrest, that's permissible in most developed countries anyway, isn't it? Like, if someone breaks into my house, I'd be allowed to do that anyway.
Okay, but here's the problem. So you have to say very clearly that you are making a citizen's arrest, and the condition has to be that there is not an officer of the law around to do that job for you, and then you have to call for one straight away. Otherwise, the problem is that if you do not make it clear that you're doing a citizen's arrest, or if you get the wrong person for the crime, or if they haven't committed a crime at all, then you could be...
done for assault.
You could be done for assault, you could be done for kidnapping or false imprisonment.
Yeah.
Or false arrest.
I like the idea that they have to specify if there's an officer of the law around, you can't do it. Like, you might just kind of step in and go, oh, hang on, officer, I've got this.
Yeah.
I mean, it can't happen very often.
You're advised not to do this under most circumstances. So if there's a chance of you getting hurt, or if there's a chance that you do it and the arrestee then turns it against you and launches a case against you for assault or whatever, then it's a big legal problem for them. So I think now, if you've got a camera phone, the police would mostly prefer that you got as much identifiable footage
yes.
of the criminal as possible. So yeah. face, voice, height, gait, number plates, all of that, than they would that you went and rugby tackled them and yeah. stopped them from getting away whilst calling the police.
Presumably as well, it's only for certain kinds of crime. I don't think citizens arrest someone for fraud, can you? Or if you think about the amount of people who have protested and say, you know, maybe they don't always mean it, but say Tony Blair should be arrested for war crimes.
Yeah.
I mean, if you went up to Tony Blair and jumped on him, I don't think the police would yeah. take a particularly kind view of that.
Yeah, but if you caught Tony Blair stealing a precious vase from John Lewis,
yeah.
that would be when a citizen's arrest was appropriate. But yeah, this is what the in flagrante delicto means. So if someone has done years of insurance fraud, say, not really appropriate.
The police must find this fucking hilarious, though, mustn't yeah. they? If someone phones them up and says, I've just made a citizen's arrest.
It's like the person who yeah. tries to take the giant cheque to NatWest to cash yeah. in, isn't it? Here's a question from Carl, who says, I'm at the end of a night shift, best place to be in a night shift in my experience, listening to the shipping forecast on Radio 4. In this day and age of instant live data on a smartphone and most ships having long-range radar... Don't say it, Carl. Don't say it. It's obvious where
How
you're going with this.
Dare you?
You're going to get angry Archers fans throwing excrement at your car window. Helen, answer me this. Is there a real need for the shipping forecast? He said
oh,
it.
Oh, no, you
he
didn't.
He went there. Are there really any sailors who tune in at 5:15 to get their weather fix?
It's on four times a day, Carl.
Or is it just a tradition which the BBC can't drop? I do like the shipping forecast. It's almost like a poem, but is it needed anymore?
Well, I mean, the poem is part of the need because the BBC acknowledge that far more people who don't need the shipping forecast listen to the shipping forecast. It's on just before Radio 4 switches over to the World Service at 1 a.m. So for a lot of people, they can't get to sleep without hearing rain, moderate or good, Dogger Bank, millibars, you know, that kind of stuff. In 1995, the BBC shifted the late night broadcast by 12 minutes, and there were debates in Parliament. There was newspaper fury. There were petitions. The BBC backed down. Can you imagine what furore would happen if they got rid of it? And also, it's such a British thing. I think because we're a smallish island, therefore surrounded by water, and with a very significant maritime history, and everyone is near enough to the coast to be able to identify with it. I read something saying that in Britain you're never more than 75 miles away from a piece of coast.
Yeah, you're never more than 75 miles away from a Dimbleby making a documentary about the coast at any given time.
And it's been on the BBC since 1925.
Yeah.
I doubt it's the most expensive few minutes that they have.
I don't think they pay very much for it because it's made by, it's not the Met Office, is it? It's, I don't want to get into the tedious detail,
no,
but it's
sorry.
Made by the Department of, you know, waves and fish
ships
and shit.
Ships and shit.
And so the BBC just rebroadcast it. It exists anyway, whether Radio 4 broadcast it or not.
Well, it certainly used to. Initially, it was the post office making it from about 1911, and it was called the Weather Shipping, and eventually the BBC took it over in 1925. But the reason why they still have it, as well as the cult devotion to it and the fact that it's like this incomprehensible beat poem, is that even though the ships might have internet and radar and whatnot, it is what they check their data against. It's also quite plausible that you go through areas where your internet doesn't work or your radar doesn't work, you know, or you're on a small boat.
Yeah.
And if you're using your eyes and hands to drive the boat or whatever verb you do to a boat, I'm sorry, you know, probably incorrect, then you might not be able to get on your phone and check. And I've been to a lot of coastal towns where you'd be extremely fucking lucky to be able to get any internet working.
Especially off coast in the rain.
Yeah.
With a touchscreen.
I don't know if you've ever helped your mum build a website. It is the kind of torment from which there is no respite. If she asks, what's a widget again? I will kill her with a rusty spike. Or a brick, or a spade, or a chainsaw.
But Squarespace is so easy, even your mum can use it. She can drag and drop and cut and paste, that's all there is to it. So Helen, put that spike down, I beg you, for Christ's sake, don't do it!
Sorry, mum.
Thank you to Squarespace for their sponsorship, their patronage of this episode of Answer Me This.
And if you're out there and you've got an idea that you've been gestating for a while and you think, one day, I'm going to make this idea into a website. You can turn your idea into a website very easily with Squarespace.
Because, so easily.
Because they have all these simple tools and smashingly designed templates.
So easy. And you could do it if you've just been recently hit on the head with a frying pan. You'd still be able to find your way around Squarespace.com.
Like Spider-Man.
A Spider-Man being hit in the head with a frying pan, Spider-Man. And that's why he wakes up with frying pan characteristics.
Spider-Man hit in the face with a frying pan. That's how it goes.
He fries an egg, he's Spider-Man. Does everything a frying pan can.
I mean, a modern-day superhero, if they were just setting up their alternative persona, would certainly use Squarespace to quickly, efficiently, and easily create a beautiful website.
Yeah, or sell merch about themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you can set up a store as well on Squarespace. And so have a play around with their two-week free trial. And then if you like what you've done and you want to keep it, and you want to get a URL thrown in with the Squarespace service, then when you sign up for a year, you can get 10% off if you use the code
ANSWER.
Here's a question from Stuart in Swindon, who says, Ollie, answer me this. Can you please tell me why cheddar cheese is not a protected food like Stilton cheese or Parma ham or Cornish pasties? Cheddar cheese is from a distinct area, cheddar.
It is, yeah.
Somerset. And has a history.
Nice place.
Yeah.
We
have been. And it has a history there in cheddar, Somerset.
Mm.
Also, why do the blessed cheesemakers from other parts of the world use cheddar to name their own cheese?
Because of its notoriety and taste.
What's so special about cheddar anyway?
It's nice.
Stuart. Is it because it goes melty and isn't too crumbly?
Partly.
How funny a name is Wookie Hole as well in cheddar in Somerset.
Yeah, that is a funny name. Although Stuart in Swindon is also a funny name because it's alliterative. I mean, depends where you are in the world, doesn't it?
Wookie Hole, so that is the specific outpost of cheddar in Somerset where the classic cheddar cheese is from, isn't it? We did go.
We did, yes. AnswerMeThisPodcast.com/Britain. You can see our trip to investigate the various different cheesy places of Britain. Our second stop on the journey is to Cheddar Gorge.
Yes.
And we saw some West Country farmhouse cheddar being made.
I can't remember much about it. I remember it being a very pretty gorge, and we went into a cave where you can see all of the cave-age cheddar cave-aging.
But the reason that it's West Farmhouse cheddar that's made there in cheddar rather than cheddar is because West Farmhouse cheddar is protected. West Country Farmhouse cheddar, that's the name that's the protected name.
Okay.
And the reason,
even though that's not in a farmhouse, it's in a cave.
Yeah, it's just a style of cheddar that has to be produced in a particular way through the process of cheddaring, which is stacking and turning slabs of curd to facilitate drainage. I tell you what, the more you read about cheese making, the less you want to eat cheese.
It's like sausages. You just don't want to know.
Exactly.
Just eat it and do not think about it.
Drainage is not a word you want to think about when you're choosing your favourite cheese. But anyway, the cheddar that has been cheddared is called West Country Farmhouse Cheddar, and that's protected. And the reason that cheddar isn't a protected name is simply because it's so old that it caught on in popularity all around the world well before anyone had the idea to protect something by region.
I don't think cheddar is a cheese with many exceptional characteristics, maybe because it's so ubiquitous now that to me it is the generic cheese, and then more exciting cheeses deviate from cheddar. But is it not an honorific that cheddar is such a successful cheese that
yes.
Cheddar made not in cheddar Somerset is also called cheddar? And furthermore, if cheddar, even if cheddar was protected,
Malad.
Could you not write on your block of cheese not made in cheddar Somerset, cheddar in big letters, tiny asterisk, style cheese?
Actually, no. If it's protected, you can't. You can't call feta style cheese, for example. You have to call it crumbly goat's cheese or whatever, or salad cheese. So yeah, that is the benefit of being protected. But like I say, many centuries after cheddar caught on.
Well, there goes my plan of making fake feta.
Here's another cheesy question from David in Camden, who's age 51 and 11.4 months.
Oh, maybe since he sent us this question, he's turned 52.
Yeah, he probably has, actually. It was a while ago.
Happy birthday to you.
Have some cheese for you. He says, Helen, answer me this. Why do we have a cheese board on a dessert menu? I suppose he means, why is it dessert rather than a starter, as it sometimes is in other European countries, or even a main course?
Well, that's quite easy to answer because cheese.
I've got all day.
Because cheese, I have talked about cheese all day, because cheese is such a strong flavour that it would kill your palate for the rest of the meal.
Ah.
And also, eating cheese at the very end of the meal is thought to be better for your teeth. A lot of food that you would have just eaten is acidic, but the cheese is alkaline, and so it's thought that it slightly neutralises the destruction of your teeth.
But some people eat cheese before they eat dessert, don't
they? The French, yes.
That's weird. Although, actually,
they would say the British habit of having dessert then cheese is weird.
Yeah.
Although I think there used to also be the savoury course, so maybe the cheese course is somewhat harkening back to that. But the French got the order of their courses from Russia, because for a while, Russian customs were very, very fashionable in France. And in Russia, it was thought that the sweet food would kill your palate, so you had to have the cheese first so you'd appreciate it more.
Uh-huh.
So I think the cheese would kill your palate. The Russians thought the dessert would kill your palate.
It hasn't caught on everywhere. I mean, in Spain, you get cheese tapas, don't you? So that's sort of like a starter, sort of like a main course.
I think probably you get a whole course in places like France and Britain because we have hundreds of cheeses and it's a celebration of them. And you might have runny cheeses and blue cheeses and hard cheeses. But there are other countries which might not have a good cheese-making climate.
So hungry for cheese now.
Yeah, me too. Let's go out now and have a whole meal of cheese. The Frenchman Briat Savarin said, "A meal without cheese is a beautiful woman with an eye missing."
Yeah. Or like Daryl Hannah in Kill Bill.
Or Gabrielle.
I don't think she had an eye missing. I think she just had an eye problem.
Well, she was like a beautiful woman.
She is a beautiful woman with one eye concealed. This analogy is suggesting that women with an eye missing can't be beautiful, which they can.
Why do people who like cheese have to be so ableist?
That's a very good point, Martin.
Why do French people make everything about sex? Or cheese?
Well, yeah, those British people make everything about cheese.
Here's a question from Helen from Hertfordshire, who says, "I recently entered a competition to win a year's supply of Weetabix."
Who wouldn't?
Me.
Someone who's wheat intolerant.
"Sadly," she says, "I was unsuccessful."
Curse you, God.
"But it did lead to a discussion at work about how a company would actually send you a year's supply of something."
Okay.
"Ollie, answer me this. Would they send you vouchers for their products so you could buy them at your leisure? Or would they post you a box monthly? Or, in the Weetabix example, possibly 2 Weetabix daily?"
Just through your letterbox.
Yeah. "Oh, the Weetabix man's come again."
Well, I mean, the generic advice when it comes to this year's supply of type competition is look at the small print and it will tell you exactly how that will be delivered to you.
Yes, because if you ate 20 Weetabix a day, they probably wouldn't cater to your Weetabix appetite.
Yeah, that's right. So there is no legal definition of a year's supply. So it is actually, you know, part of the law of offering a prize like this that the year's supply has to be accompanied by a disclaimer at the point that you enter the competition saying what that is and how you'd get it. So in the case of Ben & Jerry's, by the way, how many pints of Ben & Jerry's do you think they classify as a year's supply?
The fact that you're asking makes me think you just get 12, but maybe it's something outstanding like 300.
Is it 50?
Martin's right, it's 52. One a week.
Oh, okay.
Well, that is
that's
probably
quite healthy, actually. It's quite responsible that they're
for a Ben and Jerry's fan. That's a sensible amount, isn't it?
But do you get them all at once? Because who has a freezer, a domestic freezer, that can cope with 52 ice creams at the beginning of your year?
So, in the case of Ben and Jerry's, no, you get the voucher, as Helen suggests.
Because also they introduce new flavours a lot, and you don't want to commit at the start of the year just in case they come up with something.
So, with the Weetabix competition, I found this competition that you entered, Helen, online, even though it's closed, and I saw the terms and conditions. They were going to send you, had you won, 52 boxes of Weetabix. Okay. So again, using the Ben & Jerry's matrix there.
Oh, okay.
You know, you like your Weetabix, that's a packet a week, let's not go crazy. And I think they would send them all at once. So, I mean, that is tricky because...
Where are you going to put all that Weetabix?
Well, you see, I'd put them in my garage, but that attracts rats.
Or you could build a shed out of the Weetabix because they're hard like bricks.
You could insulate your house like the straw bale things.
My brother Andy used to eat a heroic amount of Weetabix. And I remember he once ate, I think, 48 in a week in order to get a free Captain Scarlet figure that was vouchers on the box. He wasn't even that into Captain Scarlet. I think he just set himself a goal and achieved it.
I didn't realise the Mr. On's chief weapon was constipation.
I also didn't realise that you actually literally had to eat what was in the box to be able to tear out the voucher and take it to the supermarket.
He didn't want to win that Captain Scarlet on false premises.
I guess. If you got a question, answer me this podcast to Google.com. Here's a question from Susie in Melbourne, Australia, who says, "My friend asked me to mind her axolotl for a few months while she went back home to visit family." You know, last month it was roo shooting, this month it's axolotls. This is like sort of
Australia has thrilling wildlife.
Okay, weird Australian animal of the month. Okay.
"After about 6 months, it became apparent my friend was not returning to Australia. In this time, I was becoming quite tired of the axolotl. In order to feed them, you need to drop the food directly onto their heads. as they're blind.
Well, that sounds fun. If anything, that's less boring than feeding other animals.
Being quite uncoordinated, I kept missing his head and getting frustrated. Then the water would be putrid because of all the food floating around in it, and changing it was quite disgusting and time-consuming. Plus, axolotls are slimy and gross, kind of like a prehistoric penis fish.
I suppose that's why I was never given one as a child.
Because you weren't allowed slimy and gross pets, only fluffy and cute pets?
I guess.
Susie says, I was hoping the axolotl would die soon so we could use the tank for more pretty and less demanding fish, but alas, he kept living. I got my friend's permission to give him away to someone more enamoured of axolotls, but decided to try selling him online. Within a few hours, he was taken. Someone swiped right on the axolotl.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Ollie, answer me this. Am I morally obliged to offer my friend the money, or should I keep it as an axolotl babysitting fee?
Okay. Well, I think you need to ask her, not us, obviously.
If you ask someone, am I morally obliged to give you money, they'll automatically think, well, there's a moral issue here.
No, well, yeah, but you don't put it like that. You say, since I've been looking after the axolotl for the last 6 months, I presume it's okay if I keep the money, having sold it online. But no worries if you'd like me to transfer you some of it.
Right, I was thinking it's okay not to tell her that you sold rather than gave away the axolotl, since she's evidently ascribed no financial value to it because she said you could give it away.
But then why not tell her and then do the noble thing and have told her?
Well, I don't think it's that noble just to tell her, because Susie has been stuck axolotl minding for months, maybe paying for the axolotl's upkeep.
I think it depends what kind of money we're talking about, doesn't it? And we don't know
that. Okay, yes. Okay,
if it's £500, it does get to a point where you're like, I should really tell her that this is happening.
I don't know how much an axolotl's worth.
Guessing if it's... 20 quid, fine, okay.
If it's like $100 Australian, I would just keep it. Because also, if your friend's abroad, then the exchange rate is going to take out most of their share of that. But if an axolotl is worth $1,000 Australian, then I think you have to go halves.
And presumably you have been paying food and vet bills as well.
Who knows who's paying for the food that gets dropped onto the axolotl's head. And you've been doing tank cleaning because it's putrid and gross. You've been doing all this upkeep for no emotional reward because it's an axolotl.
Also, you've done the listing of the creature online. Your friend has access to the internet, presumably, wherever she is.
She could have sold him before she went away.
Yeah, exactly. Or she could have supervised the selling of him while she was away. She's chosen not to do that. Mm-mm. I think you're on relatively safe ground, but I guess where we disagree is I would just tell her, but present it as a fait accompli almost, and you'd say don't tell her at all. Martin's just found an axolotl for sale online. How much is it, Martin?
£7.50.
Right, okay, yeah, don't tell her. £7.50? I mean, it's not even worth sending a question in.
Unless that's just a picture of one.
See, wasting our time, Susie.
Oh, no, that's a journal, sorry.
Right, what costs more? A journal with a picture of an axolotl on the cover or an axolotl?
There's one for like $20 here.
Right.
So it's not going to be that expensive. Okay.
Yeah, chill out, Susie, it's fine.
Yeah.
At least you haven't got kangaroos decomposing on your lawn.
Well, we don't know.
That's true. Yeah, maybe she just didn't mention it.
$35.
For an axolotl? Australian dollars?
The thing I was looking at before was a model of an axolotl. An actual axolotl in the US is $35 American.
Right. It's not a significant enough amount of money to worry about, so there we go.
Good to know.
Great.
Well, it hurts for us to part from you listeners, but we will be back with a fresh Answer Me This on the first Thursday of May.
We certainly will.
However, you need to supply questions for that, don't you?
Yes, you
do.
You
know the drill.
Otherwise, we'll have nothing to talk about.
It'll just be white noise.
And
that's a better name for the podcast, actually.
White noise is a good name for a podcast. Yeah, it's probably been taken.
Three white people talking shit.
And all the contact details you can use to get in touch with us with that question can be found on our website.
AnswerMeThisPodcast.com.
And if you want to fill your ears with a free audiobook, courtesy of our friends at Audible, all you need to do is go to answermethispodcast.com/audible.
And if you want to survey some of our other work, I'm doing a live show on the 14th of April in Los Angeles with... it's going to be burlesque show.
Sure, yeah.
With Roman Mars of 99% Invisible. We're doing a show together called 99% Allusional because we've combined our two shows.
And go on, tell them.
And then shortly after that, I am doing...
This is actually exciting, listeners, so listen to this.
It's pretty weird. Yeah. I'm doing TED.
Otherwise, people will be like, does TED know?
I'm doing a talk at the Mother TED.
The actual TED conference. So when people say, I'm doing a TED talk, they're usually doing a talk in their local town hall. You're actually doing the TED thing.
I'm doing the TED. Mr. TED.
Right.
Sir TED a lot.
Big TED.
Captain TED. TEDist of TEDs.
And so I get a bit lost with TED. Will that get podcasted or put on YouTube immediately?
Could be both. I don't think it's immediate. I think they like to spread them out.
Right. So at some point, Helen will be on TED on whatever device you use to engage with TED.
Unless I'm absolutely shit, in which case they probably won't put that video up.
Anyway, that's exciting. There's also your normal, well, not normal, what's the right word? Your regular podcast, yeah, The Allusionist.
The Allusionist.
And I have a regular podcast as well. It's weekly, like my sex life.
Like your bowel movements.
One of those is a true statement.
Modern Man, MANN, pun on my name. It is a weekly magazine show about sex and trends and amazing life stories.
Did you think of the show after you thought of the name?
Yes. If you subscribe right now, you will hear my interview with a woman whose ex was leading a double life and Britain's top Amy Winehouse impersonator.
What?
And also, I think the most Answer Me This style interview that I've done, which is a chat with the man who invented Baileys, the drink.
Oh.
So if you wonder, where did Baileys come from?
Did he just think, I'll put some booze and some cream together, job done, yes. Off to lunch.
Yes. Full story at the Modern Man, modernman.co.uk.
Martin?
Songbysongpodcast.com.
Yeah, you can hear all of our work. But of course, do return to Answer Me This for the retro episode halfway through the month, and then for a brand new episode on the first Thursday of next month.
Yes, and if you would like to donate to the show for no reason other than...
Ollie's baby needs shoes.
Big heart reasons and like deep that. Pockets. Then all you need to do is go to paypal.me/answermethis. Thanks.
Any other business?
No, that really is literally all our business. If our accountants are listening, we've just documented it all there. So just work with that as your template for the 16, 17 years. Just come to an end.
Thanks, Perry.
Yep.
Shout out to my accountant.
Okay, great. Right. Bye. Bye.